Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today is June 18th, known otherwise as Paul McCartney's 72nd birthday. It was almost a year ago when the former Beatle and his band played a triumphant concert in front of Miller Park's biggest crowd ever. That was a far cry from where McCartney was as the 1970s open. As we learn in Tom Doyle's new biography, Man on the Run, the time immediately after the Beatles' demise showed a side of Paul McCartney few people could even imagine. Doyle joins us on the line from the UK to tell us more. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
Do you think people overlook the importance of Paul McCartney in the music of the 1970s?
I think they do, actually. I mean, I suppose it's one of those things that obviously the Beatles were such a huge force, you know, in popular culture, just, you know, not even just music. That I suppose when it came to the 1970s, I mean, a lot of other things had taken over. Hard rock had taken over. So, I mean, when you think back to the 1970s, I mean, it's bands like Led Zeppelin and the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac, really, that spring to mind. And I suppose it's one of the reasons, really, that I decided to write the book was because I realised that it was a period that had been generally overlooked in McCartney's career.
Well, and he really, he doesn't fit in with the hard rock, and he certainly doesn't fit in with the disco influence, really, either.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about Paul in the 70s was that he was someone who had been one of the most famous people on the planet, and at the age of 27 in 1969, I mean, basically, this is where the book starts. I mean, the Beatles have split up, but it hasn't been announced. And he is plunged into this sort of depression, basically, because, I mean, he is 27 years old, and he's suddenly redundant. He has no job, but he can't announce this to the world. And I suppose that's one of the interesting things about him musically throughout that decade, is that in the 1970s, he didn't have a map, you know. I mean, who knows where this guy was going musically? And, I mean, this resulted sometimes in records that were brilliant, and then sometimes it resulted in records that were completely bizarre. But he was kind of a man out of time. I mean, obviously, there are certain highs there that we all remember, like Band on the Run and, you know, Venus and Mars is an amazing record and stuff like that as well. But yeah, he didn't really fit in completely to the sound of the times, which I think makes for more interesting music in the long run.
Well, and there's this, I think, still a misperception 45 years later that it was Yoko Ono that drove the wedge that broke them apart. But your book makes clear that it was Alan Klein, who was set to be their manager, that was really responsible. Why was he such a dangerous influence? And how was Paul able to see that while the others weren't?
I think it's a strange one, actually, and it's funny, when you talk to Paul now, any time Alan Klein's name is mentioned, right, he just flies off on one. I mean, so even after all this time, it still enrages him to think of it. I mean, I think it was one of those ones, it's difficult. I mean, the other Beatles at that time, I mean, if you've got to think about it, there was a lot of dope around and all this sort of stuff. I mean, I think their heads were kind of clouded. And also, you've got to remember that musicians are not businessmen. That's why so many of them have been ripped off in the past. I mean, musicians are really just happy to be in the studio, on the stage, making their music. So the Beatles were never very smart in business terms. McCartney, smarter, but yet again, still a musician. You know, it was one of those things that Alan Klein had already sort of managed to, how would you put it, pilfer, maybe, is the right word, or at least, you know, subject the Rolling Stones to contracts that they would come to regret in future years. And Mick Jagger actually met with the Beatles to give him his view of Klein, and kind of backed down when he was faced with all four Beatles and said, oh, well, he's okay if you like that sort of thing. So, I mean, I think McCartney saw that coming a long way before any of the others did. And actually, even though the horrible court case happened and stuff like that, they, in later years, were to thank him for that because, I mean, really, you know, the Beatles catalogue, you know, would have belonged to Abco, which was Klein's company. I mean, Apple probably wouldn't exist to this day and stuff. So, I mean, McCartney made the right call, even if it was a painful one at that time.
So you mentioned the early McCartney recordings after the Beatles. There's McCartney, and then there's Ram, which is Paul and Linda McCartney. And the reviews of those kind of ranged from not bad to not even quite mediocre.
Well, I suppose it's a strange one, isn't it? You know, because the Beatles were such a high watermark that really, I mean, I remember personally, you know, I mean, I came to the Beatles, you know, I mean, I was born in 67, so I mean, I came to the Beatles really in the 70s and stuff, right? But I remember hearing McCartney and hearing Ram and thinking, well, they're not as polished and as great, they're not as accomplished, really, as the Beatles records. But then that's to do them a disservice, really. I mean, the first album, the McCartney album, is basically a home recording. Well, it is a home recording.
Right, he really made it under the radar.
Yeah, absolutely. He made it in secret at home. And he did go and book some studio time, but he booked it in North London, away from Abbey Road and the other Beatles. He booked it under another name so that everything was kept completely secret. And that one, that record really is the sound of a guy just stretching out on his own. Now, people maybe would have expected, you know, 10 golden, glittering sort of pop songs and stuff, but that's not what that album is. It's an experimental album. Whereas Ram, which he made in New York, working with session musicians, it's a completely different record. And actually, for me, and I do say this in the book, I think it's the true successor to Abbey Road, because it involves all these sort of flights of fancy. I mean, there are songs within songs. And actually, from the early 70s period, I mean, I think that is his true masterpiece, really. I mean, everybody always sees Band on the Run as being the one. But I suppose at the time, the reason it was kicked is because he was seen as being the guy who'd broken the band up. He was seen, I suppose, as being arrogant, when actually, as I say in the book, the opposite was true. You know, he was lacking in confidence and stuff. I suppose it was just an easy thing for critics to absolutely lay the boot into him, as we say in Scotland.
Well, and you're talking in terms of successor to Abbey Road, and I think it's Uncle Albert Admiral Halsey you point to that's especially emblematic of that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've got to think about the fact that this was a US number one, right? And this record is brilliantly bonkers, you know. I mean, it's completely, it's a very, very unusual record. I mean, possibly the most unusual US number one ever. I mean, it's a mildly psychedelic song inspired by his Uncle Albert, right? That then soars off into this coda, you know, with all these harmonies and stuff.
I had another look and I had a cup of tea and a butter pie.
Butter pie?
The butter won't melt, so I put it in the pie.
All right. All right.
Heads across the water, water. Heads across the sky.
I mean, it's a really, really unusual record. And he made a TV special called James Paul McCartney. And there's a great clip for this, which is really, for me, redolent of the Beatles, which is just, it's this strange sort of psychedelic journey, which with this music and him impersonating sort of telephone ringing effects, and, you know, it's a very, very odd thing. But looking back at it now, which people can because it's up on YouTube, it's an amazing thing.
At the same time, he and Linda also recorded this bizarre version of Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Well, the thing is about that record, really, I mean, even these days, Paul's like, I have no idea why I made that record. So, and even the rest of the guys in the band sort of like, look, you know, he was a Beatle. We were going along with this. But at the same time, this is mad.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow.
I mean, I think really in Paul's head, you've got to remember that, and I suppose this is one of the sides of his character that I tried to shine a light on, you know, rather than being somebody who was supremely confident and, you know, bordering on arrogant and really self-assured and stuff, he was unsure, right? But he's also quite an eccentric guy. I mean, you usually find a lot of musicians, most musicians are pretty eccentric, but I mean, that is never really seen in context with McCartney, but this really is, you know, in terms of his 1970s work, is kind of exhibit A when it comes to his eccentricity, because in his mind, it was from part of the strain of his songwriting that had produced sort of Yellow Submarine, Maxwell's Silver Hammer. You know, it harked back to the English music halls and was just a bit of fun.
This is really the formation of Wings, and their first album is Red Rose Speedway in 73. What did Paul find so challenging about putting together a coherent band? Because Wings goes through three different incarnations through the 70s.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he had thought originally that, you know, because obviously at that time the fashion was for the supergroup. And he had kind of thought about a supergroup. He was like, maybe I could steal John Bonham from Led Zeppelin. I could have Billy Preston on keyboards. And then I suppose it was one of those things that there's something artificial about that, isn't there? And the Beatles had grown up together, and you learn how to do your thing together. So really, with Wings, I think he was trying to come up with like a band of unknown musicians. Or relatively unknown. I mean, obviously, Denny Lane had been known for singing the Moody Blues and stuff like that. But, I mean, really, I mean, Denny Sywell, who's the drummer, the American drummer, who's the original drummer in Wings, he said to me, he said, look, Paul was trying to give people a glimpse of how a band is put together, which maybe, you know, you might advise him not to have done that. Because, I mean, it was raggedy and, you know, unformed and stuff like that. But then there's something thrilling about watching that as well. I mean, I think in general, throughout the 70s, I think the problem, I mean, I asked him, and it is in the book, I said, why could you never hold a lineup together? And he just laughed and said, musical differences, which is like the classic sort of part line. I mean, I think it's one of these things that he chose the people for the band based on their musical ability over their personality sometimes. And I think that this is where the personality clashes came. And also, you've got McCartney trying not to be the band leader sometimes, right? It's just like, hey, I'm just another guy in the band. But obviously, if you're Paul McCartney and you've been in the Beatles, this is impossible.
So if the reviews of the first three post-Beatles records were mixed, what made Band on the Run so different, do you think?
I think his back was against the wall, really. You know, like the album cover, his back was against the wall. I mean, two of the guys in Wings had left basically on the eve of the making of this album, which was in Nigeria. And so Paul had, he was faced with this choice. I mean, it's like, do I cancel these sessions or do I just go ahead, right, with me, Linda, and Denny Lane, and I'll play the drums, I'll play all the lead guitar stuff, right? And this is what he decided to do. Now, the thing is, he goes to Nigeria, and Nigeria, I mean, civil war had been a massive, massive force there only like 3 or 4 years beforehand. So this was a really quite a dangerous country. And they get there and the recording studio is kind of half built and stuff. So they're faced with real trouble trying to make this record. And I think that's what it is. I mean, like all of us, sometimes if you're forced into doing something and everything's kind of against you, sometimes that's when you do your best work. And I think that's really what happened. Also, the songs that he'd written in preparation for this record were just some of the best material that he'd written post-Beatles. And so I think this was really all these different things coming together was the reason why it was such a strong album.
How would you describe where he is today at this point in his life and career in comparison to where things leave off in the book in 1980, shortly after John Lennon's death?
Well, I think the whole of the 70s is basically McCartney trying to outrun the Beatles' legacy, right, and trying to escape that huge shadow. And I suppose the conclusion that I come to, and I suppose he came to, was that it was impossible. You were never going to be able to do this. So I think these days, obviously with the formation of his new band just after the millennium, McCartney suddenly puts lots and lots of Beatles songs into his set, as well as all the 70s, 80s, 90s stuff. And I think really what he's done is he's come to terms with his own legacy. And now he's really proud of it. You know, so you go and see him now and he plays for like two and a half hours. And it's wall-to-wall hits. I mean, it really is incredible. And I mean, obviously at his age to be doing it is another incredible thing. So I think really that's what it is. I mean, you could say that these new shows are a bit of a victory lap, really. And I think no one can deny the fact that he deserves that.
There are obviously a lot of iconic songs that Paul wrote in that decade. But if you were going to point to one or two that might not be thought of as much today but are worth revisiting, what should we be listening to?
One of the songs that he started playing again recently is a track called Junior's Farm, right, which was the first thing that the second lineup of Wings put together. And it was written down in Nashville on the ranch owned by this guy, Cuddly Putnam Jr., who had written things like The Green, Green Grass of Home and D-I-V-O-R-C-E, you know, so big country writer and stuff. So they go down there to try and write and get this band together and stuff. And it's a whole eventful thing which almost tears the band apart and stuff. But out of this comes this great sort of rocker, Junior's Farm, which is really a massively overlooked thing, because it's almost, it's like a Get Back sort of nonsense rocker, you know, nonsense lyric, you know, really playful and stuff like that. But in a way, it's so joyful. You can hear him, the new guitarist, Jimmy McCulloch, is in the band at that point, and just before the guitar solo on the record, McCartney goes, "Take me down, Jimmy," right? And it's just, you can see that he's completely enjoying himself, and he's really, really, you know, liberated, basically, is the word.
I was talking to an Eskimo, said he was open for a fall of snow, went up off the sea line, ready to go. Let's go.
Tom Doyle, it's great stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, mate.
Tom Doyle's new book is called Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 1970s. It just came out yesterday in time for Paul McCartney's 72nd birthday, which is today. And on the off chance you are listening, Sir Paul, happy birthday. That's the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Let's go.